We're in session 331, faith development. Bill is not only one of my closest friends, but one of the smartest people I've ever met. And his brief bio on him would, he's from Sandusky, Ohio. He met his lovely wife, Amanda, right here on the front row when they were in high school. Bill joined the church when he was 17. And as Bill would say, it changed his life. It picked him up on a bad path and set him down on a good path. He was going the wrong way and ended up going the right way. Served as a bishop when he was 29. Started putting things on his shelf. And shelf came down when he was 4 years into serving as a bishop, about 6 months before the end of his term. Went to a stake president, talked with him, and wanted to be released early as because that's just the kind of guy he is. He didn't want to just serve out his term. He wanted to do it right. Anyway, Bill started a podcast in 2012 called Mormon Discussion Podcast. Today there's 8 different podcasts under that umbrella. Radio Free Mormon, The Mormon Wellness Project, Marriage on a Tightrope, and many others. So let's just get on with it, Bill. Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do
rock it.
So I'm a little embarrassed. I told Thomas McConkie, who's sitting in this room, because all this stuff is things I've picked up from him and other people who share the same stuff he's kind of talking about. So I said he had to throw out a question at some point to pretend like I'm the expert in the room, okay? So I know most of you are going to be familiar with faith development. I'll try to be close to the mic so I make enough noise for the recording. I know a lot of you know faith development. I hope I explain it maybe a little differently today if you haven't heard it from me. I hope you'll see this as a unique kind of little twist on it. I want to start with, again, Bill Real, host of Mormon Discussion Podcast. You can find that at mormondiscussions.org, and you can visit any of the podcasts there. But let's jump into this. So I want to start with stages of awareness. And one of the things that deeply changes as we develop in our faith is that we gain the ability to take on different perspectives. So when we are from our birth, we start off in the stage of egocentricity. And in egocentricity, if you can just imagine a baby for a moment, what does a baby do? It doesn't care about anybody else in the world. All it cares about is that its diaper's changed, it's fed, if it hurts, something is relieved. Like, it just cries until you take care of it. It doesn't care what your needs are. And so someone in egocentricity is very deeply focused on themselves. And I'm going to zip through this, and I'll hopefully leave some time at the end for some questions. But in egocentricity, we like to think of it as an early stage with just really babies or really young children. But do any of you guys know anybody in your life who, like, if they have to use the restroom and there's a line, they just go to the front no matter what? Right? Like, I've got a brother-in-law who does that. And it frustrates me because you're like, dude, are you that selfish? In reality, there are people who still have a really strong footing in egocentricity, and that's kind of where they're at. The next one is ethnocentric, and if we bounce back to somebody like James Fowler when he's talking about faith development, about 80% of the population tends to at least keep one foot kind of in this their entire lives. And as Thomas would say, we never really leave these stages completely. We always have pieces and parts of ourselves that are in these. But some people will still have a large chunk in ethnocentricity. In ethnocentricity, you're very much concerned about your tribal system. And that tribe could be your family. That tribe could be your religious system that you grow up in. It could be a club that you belong to. It could be the sport you play in high school and the rest of your teammates. There's tons of tribes within our society. And so if we are in ethnocentricity, we're going to be very tribal. And we'll talk a little bit about that here in a moment. World-centric is a stage where you sense for the first time that the beauty of your tribe isn't the only beauty in the world. Like, there's people out there and they have differences. And there's things about them that you're like, wow, they're different and they're interesting. And I want to be around them and I want to ask them questions and I want to get to know them. On some level, you begin to realize, like, your tribe isn't the end-all, be-all of your community. And you begin to value differences. And you even begin to take up causes. You'll get frustrated and angry because somebody who's different is picked on or marginalized. And you'll start to sense like, wait a minute, this isn't right. A lot of the anger that we sometimes feel when we see injustice is kind of in this world-centric stage. But at this point, we become concerned about humanity. And then finally, this is a stage I'm not able to speak with any kind of qualifications other than to articulate it maybe, which is cosmic centricity. And it's different from world centricity in that you begin to recognize human behavior across the breadth of society and the expanse of time. And so you can look back on like your ancient ancestors and realize like the mechanisms that they were prone to follow within their society and how we've developed from that and maybe where we're going, and also to recognize like all across the world today, all the differences that are out there in various societies and the values that they have. And so you begin to almost take on the perspective, in a sense, of God and see people as human beings, again, across the breadth of the society and the expanse of time. All right, so we talked a little bit about the self-preservation, survival. We talked about being self-centered and egocentricity, the inability to take any other perspective other than your own. And so I'm sure, again, you run into people who, like, they can't even, like, begin to put themselves in anybody else's shoes. I've got teenagers that are that way. They can't take perspectives. And so egocentricity, though, is, for most human beings, is a stage that we generally leave mostly behind at some point. Again, we keep pieces of it, but we generally do leave it behind. Ethnocentric. When we talk about ethnocentricity, there's a lot of these terms, I think, that apply within Mormonism. If you've had a faith crisis, you're going to recognize some of these things as things you held on to at one time, and maybe now you're trying to get away from. Black and white thinking, right? Like us versus them. Like there's us, and us is better than them. And then there's them, and them need to be more like us, right? So we recognize like black and white thinking. Like, are you a cat person or a dog person? Is it right or is it wrong? We often separate the world into a binary system. It's easier for us as human beings to label things that way. But we also recognize, if we just take a moment, that almost nothing in this world is black or white. We also with our authority. So when we look to people as an expert, so you're in this thing right now and you're listening to me and I'm the expert, right? Within our tribes, we have experts and we have the authorities that we listen to. And when you're in ethnocentricity, you trust deeply the authorities in your tribe over the authorities of any other tribe. You also trust the authorities in your tribe over your own inner voice. And so you will sacrifice your authenticity to belong. You will sacrifice your uniqueness to be the same because you want to fit in because this is your tribe. And whenever your leaders of your tribe say something, you just assume like that has to be true. My authorities know the answers. And so you're prone to essentially throw out any data that conflicts. And you don't even do it with much thought. Like it's not like you're going like, yeah, that data is convincing, but I'm just going to toss it aside and continue to believe what I want to. It doesn't work that way. Our brains are very tricky at convincing us that no, this is the better answer, even if the data is very disproportionate. We tend to be legalistic and judgmental. We tend to be strong in-group, out-group dynamics, which we talked about a moment ago. Like, what makes us us? We are better and more true. We're more loved. We're more blessed from God, right? We're the chosen ones. We're the righteous. We're the kingdom of God. We're Zion. Like, we have these terms inside our tribe. We feel the need to conform and to fit in, but more importantly, we feel the need to police others. Like, when we're in ethnocentricity, like, we go like, wait a minute, he's not walking and talking like the rest of us. And so we start to implement mechanisms that get people to get back in line. And we ourselves recognize like, oh, I'm not doing this thing the way the rest of us Mormons do it. And so we'll tend to police others. We'll tend to use words. Listen to a podcast the other day that was talking about costly signaling, that we will make sacrifices within our community, and then we like to talk about those sacrifices we make, like going to the temple. And it's a signal to the other members like, oh, this is what we good Mormons do. And if you're not a good Mormon, like, we know you're not quite fitting in, right? There's that recognition. I want to read a couple of these, and I apologize for whatever reason when this opened up on this computer, it's just a little off, but I'll read it here. In the ethno, this is Margaret Placentra Johnson. She wrote the book Faith Beyond Belief. Most of these quotes are from non-Mormon sources. I'll just say this now. There's a couple books, if you like faith development, you just have to have. One is The Critical Journey by Janet Hagberg and Robert Gulich. I think Robert Gulich has passed away now, but Janet's still alive, and they've got like a first, second, I think there's even a third edition at this point, The Critical Journey. Faith Beyond Belief by Margaret Placentra Johnson. Oh, my goodness. I know Thomas McConkie's book.
I would plug it, man.
Navigating Mormon Faith Crisis by Thomas McConkie. That's on my list. Okay. I forget that. It'll come to me. Somewhere along the way, I'll name the other one. But these are books, like, if you just want to understand development, you want to understand the stage theory and how we move along, these are great books to have. Margaret Placentra Johnson says this about ethnocentricity. In the ethnocentric stage, identity as a part of a certain group is more important than the concept of self as an individual. So if someone were to point out an incongruity in religious tenets, rather than calmly consider both sides of an issue, the faithful person or the ethnocentric person would turn away, might even label the person pointing out the incongruity as evil. If a logical discrepancy regarding religion were able to arise for someone at the ethnocentric stage, he or she would not be able to address it because of the difficulty. Have you tried to talk about the messiness of Mormonism with your family, with your friends? What happens? It doesn't go well, does it? Like, on some level, it's like, ooh, you're signaling to me that you're not one of us, and so I'm going to keep a distance from the information you're sharing, and I don't trust it. I have a father-in-law, you can even show him the data on LDS.org, and he will call it anti-Mormon. Like, that's just how it goes. Thus, ethnocentric people either do not perceive such discrepancies, and you run into that, or they dismiss them out of hand, for they are not sufficiently individuated to face life without the support of religious authority in their group. It's important to know, like, there are times in my life where I wanted to take the ethnocentric person and just, like, grab them by their ear and drag them into world centricity. But on some level, when someone is deeply at this ethnocentric level and they can't handle any kind of data that runs counter to their beliefs, in some ways, they really, that's the safest place for them. That's where they're at. And so if we have conversations with people and we realize, like, ooh, they're not ready to handle this, the best thing we can do is just back off a little bit and give them some safe space. It's that same thing we want. We want safe space. And so recognizing, like, it's not healthy to tug someone into a later stage, to compel someone to get there. As much as we're like, yeah, it would give me some validation because this sucks, right? But it's not healthy. And so as one who's more developed, looking at someone who is, and again, I know Thomas doesn't like the ups and downs, right? But someone who's less developed or in a stage back, it's not healthy to pull them along. Ethnocentric and authority. So Margaret Placentra Johnson also says the ethnocentric person is always at risk of descending into chaos without externally imposed rules. This is a big thing. There are stages in our development where we need rules. If we didn't have the rules, like, it literally would be chaos. And I know some of us in this room were to a point where we're like, no, I've got my own morality. I know right and wrong. I'll make the right choices. Some people aren't there. They're not there yet. And so if you rip their system out from under them, they don't have any rules to live by. And so now morality is, like, what is morality? They're not ready to put a stake in the ground and say, this is my morality. So again, we need to be careful. Thus, rather than the authority of personal conscience, the ethnocentric person must subject himself to oracle authority, somebody outside of themselves who claims to be the authority of their tribe. In most cases, that's provided by their religious institution. Taking literal guidance from scriptures and the literal word of religious authorities, the ethnocentric stage accepts the beliefs put forth by their church in a literal sense. Everything is literal. When you're in ethnocentricity, the stories of your tradition are literal. Whatever gifts and powers you're told your authorities have, they are literal. And there's no budging from that. Trust in the tribe. This is Margaret again. Ethnocentric people tend to accept whatever oracle authority tells them, be it their church, the government, or the leaders of their particular political party. Like, this isn't just religion, guys. Like, when you look at people who are Republican and Democrat, like, there was a time in my life where if I wasn't listening to a couple of hours of Rush Limbaugh and a couple of hours of Glenn Beck and going like, yeah, these guys are right, everybody else has nothing to offer, right? Like, this happens everywhere we go. Every system we're in is tribal, and this ethnocentricity plays out. Because they like and need the rules and structure. This is why people tend to accept this authority. Because they do not question authority in a critical manner, they can be easily led or misled by their leaders. Again, it can be good or bad, be they political or spiritual. Security, certainty, rules, immutable answers. Like, don't you remember that early stage where you're like, yeah, they said the earth is 6,000 years old, and that makes me feel good, right? Like, we take this deep trust in what our leaders are saying, and that certainty that they provide us, it feels really good in these earlier stages. These are things that leaders of their own group are traits to which people at the faithful level or spiritual development adhere tightly. They are easily threatened by change and those who do not agree with their beliefs. Again, there's that very quick tension and dismissal, deflection, when you approach somebody who's an ethnocentricity with data that's contrary to their beliefs. So this is the trust in the tribe. When I go to my friends and family and try to have a conversation about the messiness of Mormonism, there's this blanket trust that people will have in their tribal system. And you're almost, even if you've got all the data, all the truth on your side, you're still fighting an uphill battle with somebody who deeply has certainty and almost an unbreakable trust in their community, in their tribe, in their authorities. So this is, again, Margaret, and again, I apologize for it being just a little off. The ethnocentric person has a tendency to hold a literal view of God and of scriptural text. His God is external to him and judges his actions. In general, an ethnocentric person is less self-regulating than those at later stages, so he really needs to follow church rules to the letter. He cannot imagine how anyone could behave with integrity without the threat of punishment, whether by authorities here on earth or by a judgmental Father God. The ethnocentric person is pre-critical in that their faith has never been examined in an open-ended, objective manner. Perhaps because their church leader has suggested it, the ethnocentric person often holds an ethnocentric worldview where only my church is right. So we see that certainly within the Mormon tradition, regardless almost what breakoff it is, with maybe the exception of the Community of Christ, that there's this deep belief like, no, no, my church is the one, the only. And I think this is, we've got two more here, I think, in this section. Ethnocentricity and identity. In the ethnocentric stage, identity as a part of a certain group is more important than the concept of self as individual. So if some, oh, I think we already did this one. No? I thought that was a duplicate. Putting out the if a logical discrepancy regarding religion were able to arise for the someone at the ethnocentric stage, yeah, they wouldn't be able to, yeah, we've done this one. It's a repeat. So rigidity. Why do those of the faithful stage hold on to the forms and rules so tightly? For one thing, they are uncomfortable with ambiguity. It threatens the certainty that they need. Anything that is other threatens the stability of their world. Thus, they readily accept proclamations by religious authorities. That's a unique use of word by someone who's not Mormon, right? They readily accept proclamations by religious authorities that perspectives differing from their own faith group are wrong, misguided, or evil. Margaret Placentia Johnson again. So when we're in ethnocentricity, again, assuming that most of you are here at Sunstone because like you've got questions and you realize the world's not black or white and maybe you've had some kind of fracture, for someone to leave ethnocentricity, because it really works, there has to be some kind of fracture. There has to be some kind of event or perhaps a handful of events that need to happen to cause us to go like, oh, the world doesn't work that way. It doesn't work the way I thought it did, to open yourself up to saying like, oh, maybe it works in a different way. And you become open to finally listening, reading, hearing, thinking about these kinds of concepts. So in becoming open to the next stage, each person, before they can grow into the next stage, will have to begin to note discrepancies in the truth of their respective religions or their tribal system. It could be the Rotary Club. You're like, man, this Rotary Club, this isn't working. So it can be anywhere. While they are still fully engaged in them, right? We have to be active in it. We have to be engaged in it. We have to care for this fracture to begin to change our way of thinking about that system. So I think of Marlon Jensen, who is the guy who's supposed to have said, we're losing our best and brightest. And it when I think of this quote, I think of also Brother Jensen saying that. That it takes somebody who really cares about the truth claims of Mormonism to care enough to go like, something's not right here, and to start thinking about it in new ways. If they had not been ready to move to the individualist stage, they could not have allowed themselves to see discrepancies. So at some point, I think a lot of us experienced something. Somebody in the last session, I was just sitting in here before it quite ended, and they were mentioning the dark night of the soul. And most of us, I think, have heard that term. But I want to share with you, this is John Pauline. He's a Christian minister, but he also kind of sees faith development as kind of his thing he loves to talk about. It's something he spent a lot of time researching. And I haven't found a better description of a faith crisis than this. At the very height of spiritual success, now he's talking to Christian pastors. So he's talking to religious authorities within the tribal system. He says, at the very height of spiritual success, something tends to happen that we least expect, usually between the ages of 30 and 50. When followers are increasing, people are feeling blessed, funds are flowing in to support the ministry, and awards are being given, comes a very unwelcome guest. That's a good phrase. It is a personal crisis many have called the dark night of the soul. Past certainties suddenly become inadequate. We call into question everything we have ever believed and everything we have ever done. We feel like failures, like we can't do anything right. We are humbled. Our world caves in. Our faith, which sustained us powerfully up until this point, doesn't seem to work anymore. All of our answers are replaced with questions. God either vanishes from view or breaks out of the comfortable box we held him in. I love that too. We hit bottom. We reach the end of our rope. We hit the wall and can seem to go no further on the spiritual journey. We have saved others, but ourselves we cannot save. We feel completely alone and abandoned by God. And I love this. As one person puts it, just when I got it all together, I forgot where I put it. That's what it felt like. And so as I was moving through the church, it worked so beautiful. It was like, it's almost like that, and I know this reference has been made, but it's like that picture where you see the older woman and then you turn it upside down and there's this younger, vibrant woman, right? And it's almost that for me. Like I can look at the first half of my time in the church and go like, wow, was it gorgeous? It was beautiful. It worked so well. And I know it doesn't for some, but for me it did. And then the second half, these last 7, 8, 9, 10 years of wrestling with this thing, and it just feels like something completely different now. This dark night of the soul comes to many of us. And I want to share, we often talk about the idea of faith crisis. That's the phrase we like to use. I don't think it's the right word. I think we ought to call it growth, because that's what's happening. And we don't know it at the time. We don't know what to call it. And the only reason it becomes a crisis, the only reason it feels like we're having a crisis, is because there's nobody around you going like, yeah, this is normal. And let me show you what happens. Let me show you what this leads to. Let me show you about the new kinds of thoughts you can have. Like if somebody were there to hold your hand and the system was ready for when this experience occurred and said like, yeah, We used to do it that way with you, but for those who wake up to this, we have a new way of doing things. It wouldn't be a crisis at all. It would be growth. So the idea that we call it a crisis, while it feels like that, it is actually growth. Why does it feel like loss? Because we frame doubt as bad, right? Doubt your doubts, right? Questions are honored, but doubts are not, or opposition is not, right? Because if you raise your hand and say, like, I don't feel good about this, all of a sudden your doubt became opposition. We recognize in our system that we have little safe space for questions. We tell you that questions are great, but what's your experience when you ask tough questions? It doesn't go so well. The system gives rhetoric to the idea that questions are fine, because it recognizes in some way, like, that's what healthy systems do. But unhealthy systems still find some way to dismiss your question, to deflect from your question. Sometimes they even change your question. And sometimes you're made to feel shame for even asking your question. And that shouldn't happen, right? We get that. To begin holding ground that conflicts with the tribe invites shame from those still in ethnocentricity. Again, if 80% of the people in a system it is working really well for, then the moment you start to look, walk, or talk different, you're going to be seen as less than, or broken, or wayward, or tares and chaff among the wheat, or apostate. We have all these terms in our tribe for what we label you the moment you don't look like us. And if I asked you to name all the unhealthy stories of the people who leave our tribe, you could name dozens of names. But if I challenged you to name one healthy story that our system tells about someone who left, I'm guessing we would struggle to name one. Again, recognizing that unhealthiness. Also, with this faith crisis that again is growth, we often lose certainty. And a loss of certainty becomes very threatening to people who are still inside the tribe, fully believing. But this fracture gives us the space now to move into another stage. And so the next stage that we move into is called the individualist stage. This would be world centricity. This is where we begin to what was called the individuate, to individuate, or the individuating process, where we begin to see, like, oh, I can be different. I can be unique. I don't just have to do what my tribe does the best. I can do something different than what my tribe does. You begin to recognize you're unique. So there's a sense of self that becomes more important than the tribe. And again, there's a process here. You begin to feel this out. You begin to think about, like, wait a minute. There's something special about me, and that specialness shouldn't be hidden by the tribe. It should be allowed to grow and be vibrant and to expose itself, right? The need to deconstruct one's own religious paradigm and tradition. Rather than value conformity, you begin to welcome diversity, and you seek out multiple perspectives. For the first time, you place value on human beings who are outside your tribe. And you get to a point where you're like, no, they have the same value. Like, think about it as a Latter-day Saint, how you thought of, like, a Muslim. When you're in that believing stage in Mormonism, how did you think about a Muslim? How did you think about a Methodist? How did you think about a Catholic? How did you think about an atheist? And when this fracture happens and you individuate, you begin to sense, like, no, those people have gifts too. Those people are beautiful as well. You, for the first time, again, place equal value on all human beings. You first begin to look at authorities outside your tribe for wisdom, not quite trusting them yet, kind of testing the waters. Like, this Richard Rohr guy is saying some cool stuff, but is he really trustworthy? So you start there. You begin to sense wisdom also within yourself. You begin to say, like, no, I hold ground that's different than my tribe. And that ground has value. Like, that truth has value. You begin to sense that. You become your own authority, and you trust yourself. You crave deep relationship and connectedness with others on the path, and you value their uniqueness as a gift and not something to be fixed. I can remember, like, I entered this time where I just wanted to sit down with people who were different. And I just wanted to see what made them tick and see what it was that was unique about them. And I never used to do that. I only wanted to be around those of my tribe. I only wanted to be around those of Zion, right? And there comes a time where now we're taking an interest in others. There's another thing that's unique to our identity. Two things, and I mentioned this at the beginning. We want to belong, and we want to be authentic. And in earlier stages of life, we sacrifice. We lay our authenticity on the table to belong. And somewhere along the way, after we hit into world centricity or in beyond, we begin to sense, yes, tribe's important, but my authenticity has deep value and may even be more important than my belonging. And so we once again grab our authenticity and say, no, I don't want to let these people see what they want to see and be happy with that. I want them to see me. I want them to see all of me, what is unique about me and different about me. And so we begin to be vulnerable with people when we find that they're safe. And sometimes we test places that aren't safe, and that hurts. But we want to be authentic. That's something we deeply value at this point. Rules are both less needed and less useful. We realize, the world isn't black and white. So all these rules that we've been given, they just don't apply all the time. And it's not that rules aren't good. Rules keep us as a society from doing deep harm to each other at times, right? Let's just remove all the speed limits and let people drive how they want. We're all going 5 over, but we know we shouldn't do any more than that, right? There's a realization that the world needs rules, otherwise it gets really unsafe. But at the same time, we recognize the rules don't always apply, and there's exceptions to every rule. I remember going into a ward council when I was serving as the bishop, and I had just learned this great truth about how rules aren't always needed. And so I asked the ward council, I said, is lying always wrong? And I said, give me a raise of hand. Everybody raised their hand that lying is always wrong. And I said, okay, let me tell you a story. You're in Nazi Germany, and you're hiding a Jewish person in your home to protect them. And the Nazis knock on your door, and they say, are you hiding any Jews? If you tell the truth, and you can, but this isn't black and white, and you realize, wait a minute, maybe sometimes lying is okay. The rules begin to lose their rigidity. They become less useful. We develop this inner authority. Again, Margaret Placentia Johnson says, to arrive at the world-centric stage, a person must have individuated. Her concept of herself as an individual must have become stronger than her identity as part of a certain group. This does not mean she is selfish, right? We've been called selfish for this move. This does not mean she is selfish. It does mean if the values or beliefs of her group, her faith community, for example, no longer make sense to her, she has the strength to branch out. That's growth. That's amazing. To put your foot down and say, we've always done it this way, and this way hurts people, and I'm done hurting people. That's growth. That's strength. For example, no longer makes sense to her, she has the strength to branch out. Confidence in one's own reasoning power takes precedence over loyalty to and dependence upon one's own tribe. The individual's view of truth becomes more important than membership in the faith group or even the family, right? My truth matters, and it's not going to be suffocated out anymore. I'm going to stand my ground, and I'm going to tell my truth. I'm going to tell my story. So as we keep playing with this world centricity, we can end up in a place called cosmic centricity. And we talked a little bit about that at the beginning. And I'll just admit there in the beginning, I'm stepping into foreign territory in part. Well, I believe I've got a toe or two maybe dipped into this. By far, I'm still very much in world centricity. I still very much carry the anger and frustration, and I'm ready to grab the pitchfork and chase down the people who harm those that I believe shouldn't be harmed, right? I still want to fight. And fight in a way that maybe isn't the right approach because of that anger. We begin to sense the emotional capital spent in writing the world. In other words, we recognize the world is full of injustice, And we spend our day trying to consume all the injustice that goes on in the world, but with the realization that we really can't fix it all, right? And so we begin to sense that this emotional capital that we're expanding it all over the place, and we're burning ourselves out, and we're causing ourselves harm. Like, we're not doing enough self-care. And so the person in cosmic centricity recognizes, like, these are injustices, and they need to be fixed, but he also recognizes that there have been injustices since the beginning of time. And there's going to be injustices another million years from now. And there's injustices across the entire map. And so you'll pick and choose where to spend your emotional energy, but you also recognize that just the human journey will work this out in its own time. Like, it is our obligation to step up and to help and to right wrongs, but that we're not going to do it to the expense of, like, our own emotional well-being. Like, we know there's only so much energy to go around, and so we focus on the places that we can best do while also making sure we give ourselves the self-care. And so you'll notice in cosmic centricity, you'll look back until the beginning of time and say, like, yeah, we used to always hurt each other. We've always been tribal. We've always kind of caused trauma to each other when one of us didn't fit. We have always picked on people who were different. And then we look forward and we say, like, yeah, it might take another 5,000 years to work all this out. And on some level, it's not that we don't care. It's that we just realize it's a process. And so some of the anger maybe can subside. We can maybe focus our energy on the places we know we can make the biggest difference, and we can find ways to let go of the fights that we just are expanding too much energy and not making a difference. And we begin to get comfortable with the fact that this human journey is going to take some time to work itself out. We begin to sense that humans and human behavior has been happening for a really long time. Tens of thousands of years, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And we realize, like, what I do today in putting up 100 Facebook posts, which I'm guilty, am I expanding energy and not making the difference? And should I pull back and take more self-care and realize, like, oh, let me just focus my energy in this one place today where I can make a difference? It's perspective taking. In the beginning, at egocentric, you're only taking the perspective of yourself. At ethnocentric, you take the perspective of us, who look the same and walk the same and talk the same. In world centricity, we value other humans as well. And in cosmic centricity, we value human, what it is to be human across the expanse of space and time. Begin to let go of the need to fix it now. You sense that humans have always been acting in these ways for much longer than just the space of time we're working with at the moment. We approach things with the eye of God. Think about it for a moment. Whether you believe in God or not, just play along for a moment and try to take his perspective. He doesn't seem in any kind of crazy mad rush to fix everything today. He seems to sense that this is just going to have to work itself out and that we humans are just going to have to learn over the course of time. It's that perspective. It's that softer, gentler, more patient approach. We deeply sense that others are on their own journey, and their journey deserves its safe space, just as ours does. Tension, to some degree, dissipates, anxiety subsides, and we're more at peace with ourselves as we work to make differences in the world. These folks might re-engage their communities. They will enter back into their religious system. Thomas, you went back to Mormonism, right?
I
know. We may enter back into our religious systems. We may now have the strength of our own ground to go back in and be able to deal with that tension in a healthy way. So you'll see people, you're like, there's no way they're making this thing work. But they are. But they are. And so we ought to honor their journeys as well. Seeds of faith are always within us. Sometimes it takes a crisis to nourish and encourage their growth. Thank you. So that was just a boring PowerPoint. Let's get into the fun. Let's ask some questions. How much time do we have?
15 minutes.
What's that?
15 minutes.
18 minutes. So if anybody wants to stand up to the microphone, ask a question, I'll do my best.
I had a question. As we go through and we come to these realizations, I think the ages that you put were 30 to 50.
Roughly. Yeah, that dark night of the soul.
So, you know, I found myself kind of going to my parents and kind of letting them get know this stuff before they die and so on and so forth. That didn't go so well.
Right.
And then I've got kids, you know, who are grown adults, but very, you know, millennials and asking these questions. What's your thoughts on pushing that onto them earlier potentially, or is there a risk in that, or what's your thoughts on that? And from my perspective, I see it as, wow, I wish somebody would have taken me by the hand and given me a broader perspective at that younger age. But, you know, you kind of have to be really careful of how you share that with the older generation and the generation behind you.
Yeah.
And your thoughts on that.
That's a great question. This is something I think about a lot. Because I've got four kids who disconnected from the church at the same time I was disconnecting from the church. And so I raised my children to be critical thinkers, and I raised my children to find the marginalized in their schools and to be the friend. So I did that. But at some point, like, there's something that happens, which is, and I'll see if I can explain this clearly. If we allow our children to have that innocent, ethnocentric perspective, there's a lot of community that helps you to push these good values onto your children. Again, there's some values that aren't good, right? But the ones you consider good, this community is helping you push these good values at times. And you like that support, Greg. So when you tell, when your kids start moving, and my kids, like my 12 to 19, there's no doubt they're not both feet in ethnocentricity anymore from the conversations they have. There's risk because I have a daughter when she's 16 who's super rebellious and she runs away from home and she's trying drugs because the moment you're like, all those rules we used to live by, those are in chaos, your kids go like, well, maybe there's no rules or maybe I can do what I want to do. And so kids are going to test that and they're going to maybe make mistakes they wouldn't have made had the system been there to reinforce the values, maybe. But now that my kids are moving out of that rebellious stage, wow, these kids are solid. So there's a huge risk in the formative years of them making some mistakes that maybe they wouldn't have made. And I know that life just has a way of giving us some challenges. But I deeply think that by teaching our kids, in whatever words we use, this process in helping them to grow, as adults, they're much better citizens in our society.
I think that I understand the different levels of awareness and how they're needed at different times for our own survival and understanding. I guess one thing that concerns me, I sound different because I come from another place. I'm from a different tribe. And right now I'm stuck in a tribe that's, you know, having a lot of nastiness. And because I'm not part of that tribe, if I mention anything about it or, you know, I'm outside the tribe, I have no right to speak about the tribe. My fear is that I see and hear from a lot of people at least recognizing that a certain tribe that they belong to they become individualistic in that tribe. And then because of that, maybe they feel like their level of awareness has peaked, you know. But then they're still in all these other tribes. For some reason, they fail to see the connection. They fail to see, like you were saying, Democrats, Republican. I see a lot of people leaving Sky Daddy and going to Government Daddy. And then they choose authorities again. And then, you know right. What I mean? And I guess what my question is there a way for us, like, what's the best books? What's the best way for us to avoid or to learn or to cease to go into that trap of becoming that tribal again?
Yeah. So one of the things would be to not get so stuck in loyalty that you're not really willing to ask yourself, could I possibly be wrong? And I found that the most movement I experience is when I'm completely open to being wrong about the things that are most important, most sacred to my identity. Because those are the things we protect the most. Those are the things that mechanisms in our brain work really hard to keep us from seeing for what they are. So there's a psychological term called the backfire effect, which is that in order, if you, if there's a belief that's sacred to your identity, religious system, political system, you need, you can't just have a little bit of contrary information. If you get a little bit of contrary information, you're going to believe your belief even stronger. That somebody has to overwhelm you. It's why the CES letter in Mormonism works, by the way, is because it takes 1,000 issues and just throws them on the wall at once. And it overcomes the backfire effect. So in order for us to be open to change, because think of all the times in your life where someone came to you and said, like, this issue you believe in, here's the opposite data. And all you did was go online and find a source that supported what you believed in, and you just threw it back and said, I'm still right. The moment you say, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong? And you sit with the issue and you look at all the sides and you weigh where these sources come from and which data should have the most weight, and then just make the best decision. And I think when we're vulnerable like that, we'll make the most shifting.
I kind of want to bounce off of that a little bit. It seems to me that a lot of times we talk about transitioning stages, but that what we're actually just talking about is converting to a different ethnocentricity. Yeah. And so it seems to me that in your model, you kind of define what I would really consider this more individuated stage, and you kind of define it as being that cosmic centricity. What I see online is, and I want you to comment on this, is there is a kind of a progressive Mormon orthodoxy, and there is a kind of ex-Mormon orthodoxy, and if you don't fit those, they're still the same kind of behaviors that you would see in church, except for there's new orthodoxies. And so when you see people who are kind of going against that, kind of like the Thomas McConkies, kind of like the Dan Witherspoons, then what people will say is, oh, that's mental gymnastics. You're not really being Mormon, but you're trying to make it work. What I see is these people are individuating their faith, and because they're individuating their faith, they're able to stay in church, and that the progressive and the ex-Mormon communities cannot accept that because they are not at an individuated level. They're still following by the same Mormon rule books, just on the other side. So can you comment on the difference between being individuated and just really replacing one orthodoxy with believing the same thing on the other side?
Sure. Somebody said yesterday, there's nothing more Mormon than an ex-Mormon, right? You get, right? So, ex-Mormon Reddit. That was you, Anthony. Okay. I can only talk about my own experience. So I'm to a point in my life where even if I could find Mormonism a healthy enough place to stay and be in, I wouldn't be using Mormonism as the true and only church. I would be using it as a tool to help me continue growing. And so where I'm at now is I've got relationships with people immediate to me. I've got relationships with people all, you know, who listen to the podcast, who reach out. I'm to a point in my life where I just want to hear their story and how different they are, and I want to honor that that's their story. And I think the moment we are still trying to compel people to see, like, no, 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 you got to believe my story, I think we haven't fully individuated. And I haven't. I'm honest, I haven't. But I think when we get to the point where we just sit with people, and I'll use Thomas as an example. I've sat in rooms with him, and he honors everyone's story. And I think Thomas would acknowledge, like, this is how I've put things together, but I don't think that's necessarily the way it is. Like, the moment you can honor other people's truth and their stories as just as true as yours and just as deserving of validation and honor. I don't like the word tolerance, by the way. Tolerance still indicates that I'm in a superior position and I tolerate you. I'd much rather have acceptance. And to me, those kinds of ideas are much more prevalent when we've individuated.
When you talk about these stages and also the ideas of spiral dynamics, which are similar to some of these stages, there's always a hesitancy, and you even did this a couple of times, to say that one is better than another.
Yeah, I know. That's my stage four still of Fowler, right? That's my
answer. Yeah, but you even said a few things. We're losing our best and brightest. That implies that the best and brightest are moving on, right, to another stage. You said we're growing into something bigger and better. You said if someone is in a lower stage, it's not helpful to try to pull them along. So there's this sense of, and I wonder, I think we can all appreciate that one of the, you know, stages that are quote unquote higher are in a better place than some. Why the hesitancy to say, oh no, all the stages are good? Is that just because we're so world centric that we can't acknowledge that a lower stage maybe is indeed a lower stage?
If, great question. If somebody's in a lower stage, and we had this conversation, they're sitting in their chair going, oh, hell no, right? They're like, no way. Like, you guys are telling me I'm the guy on the low end of this? That hurts.
Yeah.
And so on some level, to make these conversations safe for us all to explore where we're at and what's holding us back and what's propelling us forward, you have to make the space safe for everybody in the room. And I'm not really good yet at using extremely subtle or ambiguous language. And on some level, we have to recognize you can't skip stages. You start at egocentricity as a baby, and if you're lucky, you'll get to cosmic centricity. Most human beings don't. And you can't skip a stage. They are in a progressive order. So that's a fact. But I think outside that fact, we should soften our language as much as possible to make it safe for everyone in the room.
Okay. And then just maybe one follow-up. Just you say you can't pull people forward, but if we really believe that some of these, again, quote-unquote, higher stages are a better place to be, it feels like we should be, and maybe this is the, you know, Mormon sort of missionary ideal that we share, shouldn't we be reaching out to those and teaching this and teaching ways and finding new ways to bring people, not only within Mormonism, but within the world, to a higher state of seeing things?
Yeah. I try to insert this conversation anytime I can, because I think it has value when people see that this is a normal process and I'm not alone and it isn't just a Mormon thing happening. It's a human thing. I think those are all great. There's a difference, though, when we use phrases in Mormonism like, I'm going to take their shelf down, right? Like, I'm just going to do whatever I can to have them crash. That's not okay. It's one thing to give people tools and resources. It's another thing to compel or coerce people from a place that they're not, right? Or from a place that they are to a place that they're not.
Thanks.
Yeah.
This might be more of a question for neuroscience, but I'm wondering your opinion on it.
I've got lots of opinions.
As do I. It seems like, you know, people are born with left brain or right brain, like more of one or more of the other, more creative, more literal. Some are also in faith more easily accept things like angels, and they feel like God is talking to them personally through prayer. They get answers really easily. Like, everything is just more ethereal. Whereas others are more literal. And I feel like the more literal ones jump to individualism a lot faster than the others. I'm wondering if that's something that you think they're born with. Are they born with that capacity in their brain and less of a capacity? And someone with a lot of that, are they ever able to jump to individualism? Or is everything so faith-based that they have to stay in the tribe?
So let me start by saying this is not related to intelligence at all. This isn't related to how well learned you are. But I do think it's deeply invested in how much exposure you have to people who are different and exposure to different ideas and whether you're raised to think about and given permission to kind of like, oh, I can go figure this out on my own. Like, in some families, we're like, no, this is the way we do things. And in other families, we're like, no, go figure it out. Like, let's try it. Let's see what happens if we do it differently. I think that plays a big impact. And I think there's also no doubt that all of us, our brains are structured differently. And as we generally categorize people into different camps of how their brains work, I certainly think this process is going to affect those camps differently. But generally speaking, you just have to live into it. Just life will beat you up enough to help you move this direction.
So my question is about children. My husband and I recently stepped away from the church. Our kids range from 20 years old, 16, 14, 10, and 6. My 10-year-old, fine, she doesn't care, never did. My 16-year-old is actually doing fine. But my 20, 14, and 6-year-old are having... I'm just wondering, how can I use this information to help honor them? Because I am kind of like, I want to break their shelf and like take them with me and make it simple and easy, because I feel, you know, but I still want to honor them, but I don't want them to be more confused. It's just like a very... I don't know. It's tough. I'm struggling with how to navigate that.
Yeah. we've created tribes, we've created rituals and myths, because generally speaking, it's good for most of us to have that structure. So to take your kids and be like, I'm just going to pull that shelf down, right? Like, the reality is that in some ways, our children need these tribal systems. They give our kids the structure which keeps them from perhaps making choices that would be really bad. Or what? And again, all kids make mistakes. So I'm not saying, like, if you do it this way, it works out perfect. If you do it this way, it gets all screwed up. It's just messy. But our kids in earlier stages, they need these systems for their healthiness. We did little things. And I don't think we did it that well. I mean, I think my kids have still, they still struggle with stuff. So, but one of the things we did was early on, I don't know, probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, we did a lesson on, within Mormonism, we did a lesson on Joseph Smith's folk magic. And we took, my goodness, a clothes hanger. And we broke it into 2 L-shaped pieces. And we would walk by electrical outlets and they would cross over like a dowsing rod. And we were just teaching our children, like, look at this. This is strange. And some people think this is crazy. But things like this tend to work for some reason. And so maybe it's scientifically explainable. Maybe it's magic. Who knows? Give your kids room to, like, figure it out. Mm-hmm. That, to me, seems to be the best thing, is, like, to not give your kids any certainty one way or the other and allow your kids to, like, have their own answers and work with them to, like, figure out where the ground they hold and where they stand on that issue. That, for me, has worked generally. But life is a
perfect. So, one quick follow-up question. With, like, if you had a child who maybe still wanted to attend church, like, mm-hmm. we've been supportive of if they want to, that's yeah. fine. I guess my concern is that it's going to confuse them even more. If we're saying one thing at home, and then they're going to church and hearing your parents are apostates and they're bad, and, you know, it puts them in a conflicted state even more.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have suggestions there, too.
So my good friend Chris, who introduced me, him and his wife Dawn, they've got 4 amazing children. And their kids, they've from the very young age, they've said, like, oh, that's what you learned at church? Well, we sometimes think a little differently about these things. They have a CTR up on their fireplace, but it doesn't stand for choose the right. It stands for challenge the rules. And their kids are well-grounded. Their kids are solid. And I think what made them solid was they challenged their kids to think about every issue and never accept the institution's answer, but also don't just accept mom and dad's answer either. Like, just give them, just empower them to think about these things.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay,
another minute or two. So we'll just finish up these 2, and I'll be quick.
Yeah, so with faith development, so obviously you're very familiar with your own tribe, right? The Mormon
That's
tribe
my language.
Stories, right? I'm just curious, like, have you looked into, and faith development seems to be very applicable to institutional religions. Have you looked into, like, you know, other religious institutions, like, you know, Roman Catholic Church, Eastern Orthodox, you know, that are very institutional, that are very, like, we're the one and only true church type of mentality, that have that mentality?
Yeah. So I'll say this. We, as human beings, collectively are moving through these stages over the course of time, right? There was a time, and Thomas is the one who told me this, there was a time where human beings, for the first time, collectively entered ethnocentricity, and that saved the human race. Like, think about that for a moment. Like, as much as we're angry at ethnocentric stage, the reality is there was a time in our human's history where that saved us. And so collectively, I think right now we're in one of those moments where we're edging collectively into world centricity, right? Like, we value LGBT people. We want to talk about what it means to be transgender. We want to understand that not all Islamists want to put bombs on their chest and blow themselves up. We want to understand, like, this is messy and it's nuanced. It's not black and white. So collectively, we're moving. This certainly is happening in other religions. Religions that have been around longer sometimes do better. Sometimes they don't. Look at Orthodox Jews. Right? There's this still same kind of conflict and tension happening right in the middle of that. So whether it's Catholicism, where I think it's learned over time, like, if it's too hard, people will just not care, right? So I think some religions are learning, some religions aren't, and ours is pretty young, and still, I think, in these early ways of trying to figure out how they handle this.
I'm from a Jewish Mormon background, and from two different areas anyway, and then with one of the things that I've appreciated on a lot of things within the parts, at least, of the Jewish faith, is that when kids or, like, boys are going through, their adolescent stage, is when they do their bar mitzvahs and that, and they're taught by rabbis. Part of the thing is they're taught, on the other hand, principle. You know, so you debate this, and you debate this, and you debate the truth of what you stand on, and then the rabbi would say, okay, now I want you to take the other side, or another side at least, and I want you to debate that just as fervently as you did this one. Not to come up with the idea that there is no truth or nothing matters after all. We can't know anything. But the idea that we can constantly be gaining different perspectives and then choose what we feel best about, but still have this tremendous respect, like you're saying, honoring of the others. So I think we can do that with children. I think we need the ethnocentric to a degree. But on the other hand, all the way through Tevye's stories, you know, that's what you hear all the time. Life is like a fiddler on the roof, balancing constantly. But still saying, on the other hand, when you're confronted with new information and experience.
Right. There are general ages that these transitions are healthy. To recognize, like, taking somebody out of ethnocentricity into world centricity at the age of, like, 9 or 10, it's not healthy. And so just to recognize, like, this is a process. There's a healthy way of doing it. Let's have healthy conversations around it. Thank you.
Thanks for coming, everybody.